Hello and welcome to another Linguistics CareerCast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Samantha Beaver is a workplace communication analyst and linguist, business owner, wife, and mother. She earned a master's in applied English linguistics from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Since 2018, she has applied her linguistic expertise to help executive teams, leaders, and boards of directors optimize interpersonal communication through the application of linguistics. She is the CEO and founder of Memra Language Services, a learning and analytics company. Topics discussed include research, data analysis, children's language teaching, company culture, children's books, workplace learning, work-life balance, entrepreneurship, and experience analysis. Links to Samantha's LinkedIn, website, and other resources are in the show notes. And if you think you'd be a good guest on the show, or you'd like to recommend a linguist for me to interview, please fill out the contact form on the website at linguisticscareercast.com. And if you'd like to support this show, we've got a Patreon. And we have a patron, the fabulous Lingthusiasm podcast, hosted by Gretchen McCullough and Lauren Gaughan. That's about linguistics as a way of understanding the world around us. If you're not listening yet, you really should be. I am so excited to have Samantha on the podcast today. We have known each other for a long time, but this is the first time that we've spoken in quite a while. We were just chatting about that pre-recording, that it was in the pre-COVID days, so it seems like another century. But Samantha, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm really excited.
Yeah. So you've had a really interesting career. And actually, the last time we spoke, which was at LSA, and I think you were saying it was like 2019, you know, you're getting your business together and now you've expanded your offerings greatly. And I'm so interested to hear like what you've expanded into. You've got books, you've got all these services, you've got employees. It's so cool. So let us start at the beginning. Tell everybody how you got interested in linguistics and decided that that was something you were actually going to major in.
Sure. So I had a really unique situation when I was a kid, and it sort of sparked my interest in language. My mom was a German teacher at a local high school, and she decided to apply for a Fulbright scholarship to do basically a life swap with a German family. So this program that we participated in doesn't exist anymore in its like current form. And I know that, you know, like even opportunities for K-12 educators to even participate in Fulbright related things are like greatly diminished. So it feels like magical that we even got to do it. But so what this did was essentially my mom, who was a German teacher here, she swapped roles with an English teacher in Berlin and brought the whole family like along with. So,
God, that's incredible. I have never heard about that before. The whole family. That's amazing.
Yes, the whole family. So like they lived in our house, we lived in their house, they drove our cars, we drove their cars.
Incredible.
Yes, complete, like exactly like it sounds. Well, life swap. So I was 9 years old at the time, and I have two younger siblings, and we were enrolled in the local school, and I think we sort of arrived and had 2 weeks before school started, and it was actually my 9th birthday was the first day of school, and my mom dropped me off, and it was like, bye. which like sounds crazy like sometimes when I like tell it now, but actually at the time I think I was just used to the kind of mom that my mom was, and it didn't even strike me as that insane. But as a parent now, I'm like, wow, that was like really intense, but it didn't feel that way. It felt like, okay, this is what we're doing now. And we were near Berlin, but on the former East Side, so actually many of the adults that, including my teachers, they did have many other languages, but they, most of them had Russian instead of English. So there wasn't a lot of English speaking adults around me. I was fortunate to have my teacher. She was able to support a little bit. She had a little bit of English. But really the remarkable thing was that me and my siblings all learned German within a month of being there. Really fast. It was crazy. Like, looking back, I'm really amazed at the speed of that, sort of how that acquisition happened. And we stayed there for a year and we have all these like wonderful memories and it was super formative and all these things. But then of course the program comes to an end after a year and you have to go back to your like old life, right? And the linguistic part of this is that, you know, you have this really, really intense input for an entire year, but then the input like completely stops. It's just gone. There's no more input. And, you know, my mom, she obviously as a German speaker, like did speak German with us occasionally. But I think as any parent sort of knows, you know, like parenting in your native language is just feels so much more natural, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
of course.
Yeah. So it wasn't even after we returned, it wasn't something that, you know, we did as a family, like speak German super regularly because we just weren't in that environment anymore. And what happened was that me as a 9-year-old, I somehow retained my German almost completely. Even to this day, I'm like fairly fluent in German. It's like effortless for me to like toggle back and forth between English and German. I can speak it really easily. I was able to minor in it in college. But my siblings who were younger than me, but not that much younger, they completely lost their German.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow. That's really amazing. I just have to ask, as you've gone through your life speaking German, do people say you have like a weird accent because you learned it on the east side of Berlin?
You know, no one has, well, it is true. Like, that there is like a Berlinerish sort of accent that I was able to like sort of imitate very, very well. But I think being in school and sort of learning it more in that environment helped me like acquire more of the High German. but yes, it is funny. I'm still able to sort of like slip into that Berliner accent a little bit. But so the question that I was like left with as a kid was just, why did I get to keep my German and my siblings didn't?
Yeah.
I was just curious. And I was like, how does language acquisition work? And how is language stored in the brain? And how do we learn it? And what are the factors? It was just this question that I carried with me my whole life because of this experience and sort of the different, the way that acquisition played out differently in my life compared to my siblings, especially given that even though, you know, when you think about the variables, obviously, from like a nature nurture perspective, we're all pretty similar, right? Same sort of genetic makeup, same like environment. Even though I was the oldest, we were still all like prepubescent, right? Mm-hmm. And we were all school age. So, you're like, wow, okay, so what happened? And that was the first thing that sparked my interest in like learning about language as a science. And it never left me.
That's amazing. It sounds a little corny to say it, but you were born to be a linguist, right? Like it was just something that was in there, but it's something that people say, and maybe, you know, you'll get to this as you talk about, you know, your entry into like formal linguistics, but just about everybody I've talked to has said when they found out what linguistics was, like training formally, it just clicked. And it was like, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do. And it certainly felt that way for me. You know, I was interested in languages and learning about language, not necessarily learning other languages. But when I found out what linguistics was, it was like it was just waiting there my whole life for me to figure out what it was. There was never any question that that was what I wanted to do. And I just think that there's a whole, you know, subgroup of us out there where linguistics is the thing. Like somehow in our brains, that's just the way it works.
Yes, 100%. That was the like my same experience. Mm-hmm. When I got to college, I was, well, I guess I should say, so even before like getting to college and in high school, there was obviously no way for me to study like linguistics proper or anything mm-hmm. at the high school level. But I was really engaged in like research, sort of qualitative, like sort of sociological research, even in high school. And like sort of pursued independent projects. And so that was something sort of that scientific side mm-hmm. Was something that was also kind of always there. I think for me, it's like the research questions are the things that I like just come so naturally, and I can't let them go. It's sort mm-hmm. of like, you know, from that time when we were in Germany, and then that sort of research question of why did this play out differently for me, right, than my sister, and just things like that over and over again, in sort of my life, these questions that have sort of led me to the sort of pursuit of research that happened very early, mm-hmm. and even before college. And so by the time I got to college, I knew I wanted to do something with language. I thought that perhaps it would be linguistic anthropology, actually. Mm-hmm. So I started there with anthropology classes and everything like that. But then once I took my first linguistic anthropology class, sort of like specifically about linguistics, I was like, I have to go all in on the linguistic. I was just so captivated by it. And nothing else could sort of hold a candle in terms of interest. So it was from the very beginning of my college career, like already that very first year that I started sort of on that path.
Yeah, amazing. So you got your bachelor's degree. When you were going through your bachelor's, did you feel like you knew you wanted to go to graduate school after that? Like, this isn't enough. I need to get more education.
Yes. And the main reason was because of how much I loved research. Mm-hmm. I was a part of the Honors College and was able to do like an independent senior thesis research project. I was part of the undergraduate like research program. And I also was like had a job as a research assistant as an undergraduate. So three different sort of like extra like research opportunities that were sort of extra to my coursework that I was able to engage in as an undergraduate. And I loved it so much. I was like, I just want to keep doing this. And I knew that the graduate school was the way to do that. So, yeah.
So you went directly from getting your bachelor's right into graduate school, right? You didn't take any time off, or did you?
I did, but not by choice. I actually, so what happened was that I applied to graduate schools, and I didn't get in to any of the graduate schools that I applied to. Even though I had a great undergraduate record and lots of experience, it just didn't happen mm-hmm. At the time. And so I actually did take a whole like year and a half off. And during that time I got married and moved, and then sort of had to, you know, that changes your perspective a lot.
Yeah.
And so by the time I was reapplying for graduate schools, I had already started thinking about sort of how this is going to fit into life differently. Whereas I think before, you know, when you're sort of in the thick of that, just like university life and research, you're just like, I could do this forever. You know, you just imagine it never ending. Right. But of course, lots of things change. And so that life isn't always like super sustainable. And so it was actually, I'm really thankful for that year because it helped me sort of organize my sort of priorities and desires a little bit. And so then I applied to a master's program and got in and was able to restart my graduate work. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So during that year off, you said you got married. So obviously you were very busy. Were you also working during that year?
Yes, I taught Spanish and German at a private preschool.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yes. Interesting.
Yes. So, it was my students were like 3 to 5 year olds. So all of them were pre-literate, which made the teaching like a really interesting linguistic experiment for me. During my undergraduate studies, I had also done some nannying in German, like as a German nanny. Mm-hmm. And so I had some experience like teaching like in it with a more sort of immersive approach that was like very like literacy low, I guess you could say. And so, yeah, I actually used linguistics a lot during that year to design my curriculum and how I wanted to interact with my students and those, the kind of activities that I led them through and how to assess their sort of ability. Yeah, it was a great, it was a really like interesting and fun time. But I also learned through that time that I didn't think I wanted to teach young kids always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds super challenging. I mean, I think we think of instruction in language instruction anyway, as being partly immersion based, like just speaking the language, like your experience, but also so much of it relies on, you know, homework and looking in books and looking things up in dictionaries. And when you can't rely on that at all, it's a totally different kind of teaching and learning experience. Like that's, it's sort of mind blowing. You're just shifting the paradigm completely.
Yes. And there aren't that many resources for that age group.
Yeah.
There just aren't. I felt like I was reinventing the teaching wheel. I was like, I can't use any of this. This is all like based on like the student being able to read, you know? But the thing was, it wasn't, you know, it's not like, it was a class, right? So these students, they're not, it's not a full-time immersion environment. Mm-hmm. So how do you teach in a class environment with students who can't read? And you know, it's like my students happened to be 3 and 4, but actually I think it's like it's a bigger question than that, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are lots of people who need to learn a second language that are maybe not literate themselves in their mm-hmm. first language. And I'm like sort of my parents over the years have like done a lot of work with different refugee groups that have come to the United States. Mm-hmm. And some of the challenges that they've faced with like learning English, but then having like the ESL curriculum being all so focused on being able to read and write. It's like, it's a huge challenge, right? And obviously 3 and 4 year olds are different. There's a whole host of like other just like social emotional things that you're dealing with a young child, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the same, but it does make you think like that's a really underdeveloped area, I think, from like a instructional resource perspective.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's another thing that you need linguists for, right? I'm sure that your linguistic training, even as getting your bachelor's degree, gave you a leg up on how to form a curriculum, whatever that was, for these very small children who couldn't read. You know, you had some insight into how to shape whatever you were trying to convey to them in a way that they could understand.
Yeah, everything we did had to be play-based, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the curriculum was entirely play-based. And so it was designing different like strategic play environments that would help with the acquisition of certain forms, you know? And yes, my linguistics, I could not have done it without my linguistic mm-hmm. training. I could not have. It would have been very like poorly done. Mm-hmm. I really relied on my training for that.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. I love it. I just love like hearing these stories about the things that people do where their linguistic training comes into play in ways that you would never expect, right? Like when you were getting your degree in linguistics, you didn't think that that was going to be a thing you were going to use your linguistics for, I'm sure.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay. So When you went into the graduate program, it sounds like you were thinking you're going to get your master's, but maybe you weren't actually going to stay in academia at that point. Is that correct?
When I went, like when I started my master's program, I was still pretty sure that I wanted to be a researcher. I wanted to go like for the full like thing, get the PhD, be in academia. That's still mm-hmm. what I thought. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that changed during my master's program. And I realized that through those, you know, 2 years that mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of make an exit with just the master's degree. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of different factors that contributed to that. Mm-hmm. The first one, and I think main one, is that I write right away had an opportunity to become a project assistant on a major research project. And I was very excited about it. And we did, like, I got to be very close to sort of the project was at the very beginning of its sort of development. And the professor I was working with had received a big grant to do this work. And so we were, you know, getting it sort of started from the ground up. And I was just shocked at the pace of the project, the slow pace.
Yeah.
I could hardly believe it. Like just the barriers and the red tape and the waiting and just the iterations of, it blew my mind. I was like, what? This can't be. But then I, you know, realized being in that graduate environment and working more closely one-on-one with different professors, that lots of academics spend their whole career working not so much on the same project, but almost kind of like, right? Like, just these iterations of this one focus and years and years and years of development to get a very like certain small outcome. And that was like, it's a little scary to me. I was like, I don't think I want to do that. I have a little bit more of I'm certainly a researcher, but I think I have a little bit more of an experimental edge, a little bit more of a try fast, fail fast kind of personality. And I think I'm so glad that I was able to see that right away and be like, this is not probably the right fit for my sort of disposition. And I don't know that I would be like happy in that type of research environment.
Yeah.
So that was like the first thing. and then the second thing was that halfway through my master's program, I became pregnant with my first child. And that also changed how I was thinking about everything I wanted to do. The sort of whole process of like pregnancy and having a baby while being a graduate student and all of that, like, and of course, as anyone who's had a baby knows, it's just like completely paradigm shifting and one of the most challenging things that you can do. And I just realized, I think what I took away from it was very empowering. Like I did this really hard thing. And then I thought like, man, if I can do this thing, if I can like get my master's degree in linguistics and like have this baby and, you know, whatever, I can do anything, you know, it sort of broke all of my boxes of, you know, like what needs to happen when, and like what, like following certain paths and tracks. It was very like, it was sort of liberating. It liberated me from thinking that way. And that was actually the very first time that I even conceived of the possibility of sort of starting maybe my own business. And it was really because of that. I don't know. Yeah. Well, liberation, I guess. Yeah.
That's amazing. I was just talking with someone the other day about the whole graduate school experience, and getting your PhD is, in a way, even worse. You know, graduate school is not designed for women, especially, and it's certainly not designed for women to like proceed with your life and, you know, being married and having kids and all that. It's really designed for men. And it's designed for men who have a support system around them to do all the things that men traditionally don't do, right? It, you know, like running a household and having kids and taking care of the family. Like there's no built-in time for you to do that. When you're in graduate school, you're supposed to be devoting all your time to the graduate school experience. And if you don't, it's not as good. It's so hard. And if you're working, it's so hard because you don't have all this free time to do all these things that you're supposed to be doing, like going to colloquia and meeting with your professor and striking up conversations in the hallway. And when you've got kids to attend to, you can't do that, right? Like, you just can't hang around. You got things to do. You got kids to deal with. Like, you just can't. So the fact that you were able to do that is amazing. Like, wow, I'm so impressed with that. That's incredible.
There were moments where it felt like I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I have like my strongest memory is just that like we were just a few months like away from graduation, but you know, like in that busy time, right, of getting things done. And I had my son, he was wasn't with me at the time, but I just like trying to make it across campus between from one class to another class with like a 10 minutes, right? But you have to walk all this way, and I had to pump, and I was like, where can I pump? And then like I was pumping in, like I knew certain bathrooms, right? But then of course at the time, like now, you know, there's all these like really like easy to use, like fancy, like whatever, like no plug needed breast pumps. But at my breast pump, like I needed to plug it into the wall and I needed to like set it on something, right? And there were like the outlets in these bathrooms were in the craziest places, you know? And so like sometimes I'd have to sit like behind the door, like plug it in. And they were like, you know, the university of course would be like, well, we have like one mother's room in the English building. And I'm like, but I have a class over here and then another class over here, and I don't have time to go walk all the way to the English building, you know, to pump between my classes. And then of course, you know, you're just sitting there behind the door, basically boobs out, and all the undergraduate students are walking in, and you're just like, this is insane. Like, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know, and of course you're just like so tired, right? So you're just like sitting there tired, like like nude, you know, just it's just like such a vulnerable, like there was some moments where you feel really like a little bit debased, you know, where you're just like, there's like no dignity in this right now. And I feel completely cast aside, you know? Yeah. There were hard moments like that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Oh, well, thank you for mentioning that and sharing that. And I know that there are lots of other folks out there who will totally identify with that story. I think I said when I was talking to someone else once during the podcast that we need to normalize crying in graduate school more, because there were many times when I cried in grad school for various reasons, not for the same reason that you just did, but you know, there were so many times when it's just overwhelming, when there's just so much happening and you feel terrible for lots of reasons. And the attitude that the university and the department often has is like, well, just suck it up, right? You know, like, why are you so upset about this? Like, well, because it's upsetting. That's why. As humans, we are affected emotionally by things, and you can't just go through your day like this doesn't affect you. Of course it affects you. You're a human. You have emotions.
Yes. It's so true.
Yeah,
yes. I have to say, though, that although, like, there were lots of those hard moments, on the whole, I do feel like my department was very, like, they supported me as well as they could with, you know, the pregnancy and sort of giving birth and everything. They were extremely flexible. They made space for me to bring my son with me for, like, as long as I needed to. So I did, like, bring him to class. And, it was really, I can't complain really about how sort of on the individual level I was supported through that. But just from an institutional perspective, like there were some gaps.
No, that's great. I'm so glad that your department was supportive. That's really awesome to hear. Not always the case, but it's great when they do it. So yay. I'm glad for you.
Yes.
So as you were saying, you know, you're reaching the end of your grad school career, and you're seeing that there are other options out there. So, like, what were you envisioning as your career path post getting your master's?
Yes. Okay. So, at about this sort of time, like having the baby, whatever, it just so happened that this was at the same time when the sort of concept of company culture, like, just like emerged. Like, it just became all of a sudden a thing people started talking about. So this would have been like, I don't know, 2016, 2017.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was, just like this new idea. And of course, my husband during this time was like working in industry, not a linguist at all, just doing other things, right? And so he was also like, he was coming home and telling me about, you know, just his coworkers and these things and like this new idea about company culture. And I as I just assumed, I was like, well, there has to be like tons of linguists working on this because if it's all about like, it's basically, you know, linguistic inquiry, but just like on a micro, it's a microculture, right? Like the workplace environment. And so I was like that, you know, that might be a really cool thing to do. Like maybe I'd like to do something like that in industry as a linguist. And so my first approach was like, I'm going to find these linguists who are doing this, and then I'm going to go work for them. Like, I didn't think like, oh, you know, I didn't sort of set out to become like entrepreneurial. I just had this idea about linguistics being able to inform company culture. And I assumed that there were other like people doing it and that I could work for them. But I didn't find people like that. I have certainly found lots of like amazing companies in my research, right? But I really wanted it to be like linguist owned and operated, where language was like at the forefront. And I couldn't find that. And I think like when I look back on it now, I'm like, it was silly of me to assume that because it was still very early in the like sort of company culture cycle. You know what I mean? In terms of its like, whatever, emergence on the scene, you know? But then when I couldn't find it, I just like all of my research questions, you know, from my life over the years, right? I just couldn't let it go. I had the idea now, you know, and I was like, but this is still a good idea. Just because someone else isn't doing this doesn't mean a linguist shouldn't be doing it,
right, you know?
And so that's then how it started. And actually in my last semester of graduate school, there was a graduate seminar where we had to do an independent project. And even though it was very unorthodox, I asked my professor, I was like, I'm starting to think that maybe I want to start my own business. Can I like use the semester and like this course to like basically develop the entire business with like all of the like sort of different details and whatever, and then pitch it to the class as my final project? And she said yes.
Wow. Bold of you. That's amazing. That's great.
Yeah. I was like, well, you know, if I'm kind of sure that I'm not going to continue on to the PhD, like I'd like to, you know, like I'd like to put my sort of research efforts toward my next step, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm very thankful for someone who is just so open-minded and like, yeah, that's awesome. Do it.
That's great. What you just said really resonated, like looking at an issue that's out there world and immediately going, oh, there must be linguists who are doing something about that. Because I think as linguists, we think that all the time. You're like, oh, naturally there will be linguists working on that. And you're like, oh, there aren't any linguists working on that. Well, there should be linguists working on that. And then it's sort of up to us to go, well, I guess I'm going to be the linguist working on that. So yeah. I think we all as linguists feel that pretty keenly. And the good thing is that there are a lot of people like you who are willing to step up and go, okay, well, if there isn't anybody doing it, it's going to be me and I'm going to do it. So, you know, there are many, many entrepreneurial types of linguists out there and we're getting there, right? Like slowly but surely we're filling those gaps and we're stepping up and creating the businesses that need to be in these places. Because when it comes to things like, you know, you're talking about company culture and the way language is used in all these places, who better than linguists to be the experts in those places?
Yes. Yeah. No, I completely agree. And it is true. I feel like I am in such good company when I see all of the other businesses that have been started by linguists. They're all always so cool. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, this is like, it's the best. It's the best company to keep, you know? There's nothing better than a linguist entrepreneur.
So what kind of grade did you get on your final project in that seminar?
Oh, I think I think it was just a pass fail. Like it was one of those graduate seminars that was very like, so, you know, like project based and a really small class and like kind of very meta. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. I don't even know that I got a grade, but I had a great response from my I got a lot of really good feedback on like the idea and sort of how to position it. And, yeah, so it was very useful.
Okay, good. That was my next question was if you didn't get a grade, like how was the reception, I guess? Maybe that's more important.
Yes, I do think that, and you know, this is true, I think at every stage of running this business that the first time I talk about it, like some people get it right away, but not everyone. And even in my my sort of cohort of graduate students, even though they were all linguists, it's not always obvious, like the application isn't always obvious to everyone, right? Mm-hmm. It seems so obvious to me, but I have really come to learn that it is just because it seems obvious to me does not mean it's obvious to everyone else. And so, yeah, I sort of got some of that feedback right away, and that it was useful early on. And I think, you know, I've been running this business now 7.5 years, mm-hmm. and it is that sort of like positioning and how to sort of capture and solve for the needs of like a customer base and sort of make your services immediately known is still like the hardest thing for me about running a business. I think it's very challenging.
Yeah, I agree. So let's do it this way. Can you tell me, pretend that I don't know anything about your business, like break it down for me in the non-linguist way. Pretend I'm not a linguist. How would you describe what your business does?
Okay. Well, first I usually say my business, Memoral Language Services, is based in linguistics, and we offer two main services. The first one is called OrgLearn. And OrgLearn is very much like traditional learning and development for organizations. The only difference is that all of the OrgLearn learning sessions are based in linguistic research. So if you're learning about how like generation or gender impacts like work and in the workplace, or if you're talking about like self-advocacy at work, all of these very like topics that are very relevant, and I want to even say like almost commonplace things that we talk about in the workplace, especially in a learning and development context. These are all things that we also talk about in OrgLearn sessions, except that the entire sort of basis of the training is all about language and how language is the key variable that impacts all of these sort of larger ideas at work. So that's the first service. The second service is OrgLab, and this is our analytical service. The best way I think to describe this is as a sort of experience capturing and analyzing service. So whether that is employee experience or user experience or customer experience, what we do is we gather the available language data that most companies have this sort of latently, especially in the post-COVID era, when you think of all of the meetings that are recorded and all of the Slack channels that are used, and just like tons and tons of language data just floating around. We take that data and then we analyze it for key linguistic features based on the company's goals. Sometimes the company is interested in, you know, sort of a more culture-oriented experience analysis. So they're looking at like those types of like factors, like how do people feel at work? How are people like fitting in on their team or acting, or like what's their sort of like psychological profile at work? But other times it can be much more like even culturally oriented, right? It can be more about the actual like experience of using a platform, mm-hmm. and capturing that data. And the data analysis, the sort of deliverable on that is a report, just like you might imagine. We sort of treat these like research projects. And the through line for all of them, again, is that they're all analyzed linguistically, of course, with metadata, relevant metadata as well. They're analyzed linguistically. And really what they do, regardless of the project, and regardless of the client, is that we're capturing experience. Mm-hmm. And I always say that this is so important because when you look at a sort of industry and how they collect data, they almost always default to surveying. And surveying is a really, really great tool for capturing information like, you know, who's available on Wednesday, mm-hmm. and was that training useful, and those kinds of things. But surveys don't do a good job at capturing experience, like someone's like lived experience of a certain moment. And so that is where linguistics steps in and sort of takes like that more like long form data where someone's describing their experience and is able to analyze it and break it down in a way that's meaningful for an organization. Mm-hmm. So that's Org Lab. And that's what Memra does. We do those two things. And of course, you know, as I'm talking to you, that is like our primary service offerings, right? And when I, the linguists that sort of consult with me, those are the projects that they help me with, the Org Learn projects and the Org Lab projects. But of course, there are lots of other projects that I've taken on over the years that kind of fall outside of these two service offerings. And, you know, as with anything else, you know, things sort of change and evolve over time.
That's great. I'm just looking at your Memra. It's memralanguageservices.com. And it's so cool to see the word linguistics all over your website. I have to say, like, it's not a hard sell exactly, but I like that you're not afraid of using the word linguistics and linguists and linguistic terminology here. It's really nice. Like, you know, sometimes people are very afraid of using the word linguistics because they feel like it scares people off. But you have integrated it so well in here with like the normal kind of, you know, the way you have to do marketing speak on your website to get people to understand what you're doing. And I love the fact that you've used phrases like communities of practice, which is like straight out of the sociolinguistics books. Like, yay, I love that phrase. It's awesome. So it's really nice to see how you've woven linguistic terminology and linguistic concepts into this sort of, you know, corporate type of deliverable, which other people have done before, obviously, but you put this really cool linguistic spin on it. It's just very cool to see it.
Yes. I also was a little bit afraid of those words early on. And I, you know, would just go back and forth like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work, you know, but what I found was that the type of client who was really, really turned off by like using words like linguistics or like communities of practice, and you know, sort of reacted like, oh, like I can't understand that, or like, well, you know, whatever. They weren't the type of clients I really wanted to work with, you know. And I think that was so important to say, like, you know, Memra Language Services is not like a good fit for everyone. Right. It requires a certain intellectual curiosity. And that's good because those are the people that I want to work with. Right. And as I'm like, it's the business that I want to build. And so that was sort of an important part of becoming brave in just stepping into a brand that was very linguistics forward.
Yeah. Oh, it's just so awesome. I think, you know, this is something that people, I think, are becoming more aware of, just that all of this stuff, like you're talking about company culture and surveys and the way people are communicating, it's all language, right? And small changes in language and noticing small things have such a huge impact on the way things are communicated within a company and between companies and their customers. And they have to be aware of it, you know. In I've said this before on my side, you know, I do naming and I try to help companies get very consistent with their language. And they're just like, stuff just goes by them and they never even think about it when you're helping a company with their, you know, website copy. And I know you've done copywriting and that probably comes into it at some point too. When they don't use terms consistently, you know, like you use different words for the same thing, it's like, hey, that's confusing to your customers. And they go, oh, is it? It's like, yes, of course it is. Like, you really need to pay attention to that sort of stuff. Honestly, guys, like, you should clean up your vocabulary. And they kind of go, oh, yeah, we never thought about that. It's like, yeah, it's language. And, you know, you should be consistent. It's important to have some discipline around that kind of stuff. So it to us as linguists, very obvious. To them, it's just not a thing that they've really thought about before. So just making them more aware of it is so important. And that's like the power of your business, I think, is just making them aware of it.
Yeah. Yes. I completely agree. Language is something that is so much a part of who we are that we just take it for granted. And I yes. think that there's actually a lot of, like, that says a lot about it. Like, there's a lot of power in that. Like, it's good that you don't have to think all the time about language. It should feel natural. It should feel like it's just this part of you, you know? Mm-hmm. I want people to feel that way about their language, right? That it's part of them and that they're not constantly, like, self-editing. On the other hand, though, because it is so much a part of you, if you can take a step back to be a little bit more analytical about language in general and how you're using it and how the people around you are using it, it can be so powerful. The things you can learn about yourself and others and your, like, in a workplace context, like your team and your clients, it is never ending. Like, it goes so far. Mm-hmm. And yeah, all of this, of course, is primarily in the context of, like relationships. What I like mm-hmm. have found is that, almost all the projects that I work with or work on for different customers or for different clients, no, regardless of the specific focus of the project, it often comes down to how language is used in relationship, almost mm-hmm. always, and how to sort of understand that and capture good data around that, and then also do that better.
Yep, totally. I mean, language doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? Yeah, so it's right. always about trying to communicate something to someone else, whether that's your coworker or your boss or the board or your customers or, you know, your partners. You know, if you have a partnership relationship between two firms, it's always about how you're trying to communicate something with them, unless you're talking to yourself, which I guess is a whole other thing. But you know, you never communicate everything perfectly, but you want to get as close as possible and you want to do it in good faith. And that's another whole emotional area that is very difficult to, it's a minefield sometimes. It really is.
Yes, it is. It is. And it's powerful though. There's something also about like doing that, helping people through that process, but saying like, I'm here as a linguist. So I'm paying attention to what you say, right? It almost takes the pressure off a little bit. I found some of the like, I don't know, like the deeper things, like it's not that we don't care about those deeper things, but it's just sort of like, I'm here for the language, like whatever's going on under the surface, we don't have to go right. all the way into that. Like it'll come up, right? But we can focus on the language. And I think actually like it, sometimes that frees people up to just be like, okay, like I can do this. And then we end up going pretty deep anyway, you know? But yeah, it's good.
Yeah, yeah. No, it totally is. I feel like I think I said this once, but when large companies have like company retreats and things like that, I feel like they should have a class on sociolinguistics and just go like, let me teach you about Grice's maxims. That would help everybody out a lot if we could all just agree that we have a starting point for this. And it doesn't always work perfectly, but if we could all just agree that this is where we start from, it would help our communication greatly.
Yes, I completely agree. Yes.
Speaking of which, I noticed that on your website, you have a bunch of different books that can be bought, and they deal with these exact things. So you have things about discussing assumptions, discussing disagreements, discussing promises. I mean, that's all about these very things. Like when you get to the minefields, how do you negotiate these things? Because it's never going to be smooth sailing, right? Like these things come up, people disagree, people have arguments, people make promises, and then they break them. So there are ways that you can negotiate that without, you know, your world collapsing. How did you come to write these things? Like, were they outgrowths of projects that you have, or did you just think, I'm going to write these books?
Well, they weren't direct outgrowths of projects. However, I feel like everything that I end up doing, it's like, so like, I couldn't have done it without the things that I did before mm-hmm. it. You know what I mean? It's a very like, the experience is just constantly building and it's sort of leading naturally to the next thing. So no, not a direct outgrowth. However, I would never have gotten to a point of feeling like I could distill linguistics to the degree that I did for those books if I hadn't been practicing for years and like starting Memra and working with clients and things like that.
Yeah. To be clear, these books are for young adults. Yeah, I would not hesitate to buy and give these books to many adults in my life, just saying.
Yes, yes. So it's a K-12 series. And the idea I had that came to me first was actually about idioms. Like, I can't really remember the exact like moment per se, but I remember at one point realizing that there are just like so many idioms in English about language, like these sort of turns of phrase. Yeah. And so that was what like it captured my attention. And then I kind of realized that the purpose of these sort of cultural idioms was to actually sort of direct how we talked. And that is what made, like, I just got really curious. And I thought it would be a super useful way to frame linguistics for kids, because kids are like hearing and using these types of really common cultural idioms all the time. And that's sort of how I started with the book series. And I sort of fleshed out a very basic idea. I had no experience with the publishing world at all. But I just asked a few people that I knew who had published, like not the same type of thing, but like sort of in a similar space. And they gave me a few recommendations and I pitched it, and I was picked up right away by Routledge. So it was like a completely like seamless publishing process.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. Again, talking about language is something that we just don't do enough, right? Like, as you were saying, everybody uses language all the time. We just don't think about it. And I think that this is something, especially with kids, where we should talk about the way we use language more. It's usually done in a corrective way, right? Like, don't say that, or you're doing too much of this, whereas you don't really stop to examine it or say, if you tried it this way, it might be a little bit better than what you're doing to get a better result. Like, or just kind of analyzing in a linguistic way where a conversation might be going wrong. And that's a much more productive way of doing it, again, from a linguistic viewpoint.
Yes. And it's so helpful because, like, so I have a son who's actually now in the target age range for these books, right? And so I see some of the things that, you know, he like is learning at school. And I think even like just the social emotional learning curriculum is such a big sort of trend right now in public elementary schools. And so they talk a lot about, you know, like feelings and bullying and all sorts of, and trauma and things like that. They have like a pretty robust curriculum for this. But they don't talk about language. And I think that is a huge miss, because in the end, what you experience when you are like interacting with someone who's dealing with trauma or who is a bully or like who's going through something emotionally like challenging, the way that you experience their trauma or emotions or whatever is all linguistically mediated, right? Definitely. These kids are like language is the main signal that they're getting, right, in these situations, and yet it's not the thing that's like being trained up, right? So yes, that's like just one example where I'm like, oh, you know, like such a miss. But yes, and so that's also, I hope that this like series can also be like something that can sit in the gap there too.
Yeah, and I will also say, to bring it full circle, you and I know lots of the other linguists that we've talked to who work in industry, have encountered so many people in the corporate world who obviously never got this kind of information when they were younger, right?
Yes.
And they have such poor communication skills as adults because they just don't know how to communicate, right? They just can't. Like, they are incapable of communicating clearly and effectively, or dealing with disagreements, or, you know, expressing disagreement in a productive way. And it's very, very frustrating when you are working with a team of people and there's one person who will not express disagreement in a good way, you know, that they'll be passive aggressive about it, or they won't say anything. And then you come to the end of a process and then they'll just torpedo the whole thing because they, right? They haven't been able to say anything till then
because
they just haven't learned how to participate with their words until the very end. And then they just have to come in and show everybody that they're in charge by saying, no, I don't like it. And it's all language. It's all language. And, you know, I think what your firm does, hopefully, is a bit of a remedy to that. Although obviously some people are never going to change, but it is a healthier environment when people can actually talk about things and by trying to change at least the company culture, it can provide a better environment for people to call it out when there is maybe one person on the team who's not communicating effectively. You can say something and not just everybody have their feelings hurt because this one person will not participate.
Yes, I completely agree.
This is also cool. So you're doing this, you're an entrepreneur, which is amazing. Where do you see your business going? I mean, you're obviously very successful right now. Like what's coming down next for you?
Yes. Well, so after writing this series, and it was published in 2023, mm-hmm. I knew right away that I wanted to write more books because I loved it. I loved everything about the process. I loved the publishing process and like the work of writing. Like I just, it was completely like, it really filled my soul. So I knew I wanted to do more of that. And I was kind of waiting because, you know, you can't force a good idea, sure. right? Like mm-hmm. you sort of have to think about, you know, what's going to be. And so right now I'm actually in the process of writing my second book. Or I guess not second book, but like another book that's separate from this series. And that is what I've like sort of done to do that is I've like paired Memra back a little bit just for this time of writing to be able to focus on it. And hopefully this book will be it's sort of designed to be more of a general trade book. And I'm really excited about it. It's called Language Rich. Mm-hmm. And it sort of plays off this metaphor, like an economic metaphor, the idea that the sort of secret to like true wealth is not to be rich in money, but to be rich in language. And like, what does that mean? Right. And then it goes through like several different sort of sociolinguistic, pragmatic, sort of linguistic anthropology, like sort of different principles, and then builds those out, into some sort of, well, I guess maybe not out, but sort of distills them. And the metaphor is sort of the through line and the organization of the book. So that's what I've been working on. And that's like, it's just so front of mind because it's been like very, you know, like when you're sort of in that type of project, mm-hmm. I don't know like what this exactly like means necessarily for a member of the business, but, I am hoping to do more sort of like general trade focused writing in the future. And we'll see how that changes what Memra is and what I do with Memra. But it's been just a journey that I'm so thankful for and the flexibility that it's given me to create the life that I want to live. Mm-hmm. It has been a real gift.
No, that's amazing. When might we see this book?
To be determined.
Ah, okay.
I don't know. But hopefully sooner rather than later. And okay. I would love to update you and also all the listeners of the podcast, you know, too, like when I know more about that, because absolutely this book would be, I think, very interesting for certainly for any linguist. Mm-hmm. And it really sits at in sort of that like I don't know like sort of pop science sort of mm-hmm. inquiry category. I think it's also interesting for non-linguists too. Just takes, like I said before, a little intellectual curiosity is all you need.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. We've done book launches here before, so we're very happy to help when it finally comes out. That sounds cool. Cool. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you wanted to mention? Any fun hobbies that you have that you wanted to get in there to show what an incredibly well-rounded person you are?
No, but one thing I will say that I think probably didn't quite come across is that I've actually never run Memra full time. Obviously part of my story is that I had my first son when I was in graduate school, and part of like that was part of the impetus for starting this business. Mm-hmm. But what that also meant for me was that when I was getting started, like, I mean, I was home with him and I was working on the business, and that has kind of been the dynamic for all 7.5 years. Mm. Obviously, you know, every year looks a little different in terms of like time allocation for work versus family. And, but I think it's important to say, that, you know, I didn't just like start the business and put my kid in daycare and like have enough like money to like fund my whole life like right away. Not at all. In fact, it's not even really like that now. But I think it's important to measure success, to have a way that you can measure success based on like the kind of life that you want to live instead of some sort of arbitrary measure of like, well, if I'm not doing this full time, it's not a real business. If I'm not making this amount of money, it's not successful. That would be like, that's just a really important message that I would want to be like, it's a very truthful part of my story that I don't want to be missed, right? So that you just land on my website and think like, wow, like she's amazing. She did all this stuff, but it doesn't, you know, it's not, it looks neat and tidy on a webpage, right? It's just not neat and tidy. And, you know, it's just a part, Memra is a part of my life and my life is much bigger than Memra, right?
Yeah, of course. And I think that is so true of just about everybody that I've talked to. And that's the lesson that everybody, you know, needs to take to heart is that your career is going to take you everywhere, right? It's going to take you up and down and sideways and around corners that you never expected it to do. And we never know where it's going to go next. And this is a thing that I think we're very good at as linguists is kind of going with the flow where these things might happen. And it's very different from what we get told as the academic life is going to be, right? So when you're an academic, you go and you go work at a university and you're there for the next 30 or 35 or 40 or whatever years of your life. And that's your job. And for some people, that's great. Like that is what they want. And as you were saying, you're working on the same project essentially for the rest of your career. And for people who can do that, like amazing. That's so cool that they can. But for other people who don't want to do that, there's this other path where you get a lot of change and there are different parts of your life and sometimes they overlap and sometimes they don't. And that's okay because you get to do these different things and you go through phases and you might end up in a totally different career 10 years from now. And that's fine.
Yes,
it's just the way life is.
Exactly. And that's the way, you know, when I think about the like sort of future of Memra, I don't think that far out, right? Because I just don't know. And I think I've like, if entrepreneurship teaches you anything, it is to become okay with ambiguity, right? Most people are just not, they really don't like ambiguity. They just want to know. They want to know like, is this going to succeed or not? Like, should I do this or not? And there just aren't that many answers like that in life. And so like, I don't really know exactly what Memra will look like even 5 years from now. And I am very confident that it will be somewhat different than it is now because things just are constantly evolving. But that's part of the ride, you know? And, if you can sort of handle the ambiguity, then that ride can be pretty fun. But if ambiguity is not your thing, then it's probably not for you.
As an entrepreneur, I totally agree with you. And you know, saying yes to opportunities as they come along is important too, right? You have to be open to what comes your way. And I'm having talked to so many people who have like these very interesting side gigs, being game designers. And the one person that I talked to who has a side career as a restaurant reviewer, you know, it's like, cool. Like, you have these opportunities. It's like, why not? Just do it and see if it turns into something. If it's something that you enjoy that you want to do, you should probably just try to do it. You probably never thought when you started Memra that you'd be writing these books, right? But you did it and it's cool. Yeah. And now look, it's turning into other things. So you just have to do it. So that's great. And thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a super important point. And who knows, like you said, who knows what's going to be happening in 5 years? Nobody does.
Right. Honestly, for real, we don't know.
Yeah, for real, we don't know. I mean, things are changing on an hourly basis. It's kind of insane at this point in the year of our Lord 2026. As we wrap up, I wanted to mention that I will put your website and your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. If there are folks who want to contact you, perhaps for informational interview or advice, is it okay if they contact you via LinkedIn or via your website?
Yes, absolutely. Please do.
as linguists, we always want to stick together. And I know that folks will be, you know, want to know more about your biz and probably talk to you about what you're doing.
Yes, that there. Please feel free to reach out, anybody. Yeah,
that's great. Well, Samantha, thank you so much for spending an hour with me. This has been so much fun. And I look forward to talking to you about that book when you're done with it.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me to do this. It was a joy. And as always, like, you know, just even having the opportunity to just look back and tell your story from the beginning, there's just like, there's something therapeutic about it. So thank you. It was wonderful.
It was great. Thanks again.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.